Let's talk about the post-flood existence. This is after the flood. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You know, the first chapters of Genesis speaks of an earth that is pristine, okay? Holy, beautiful. As God declares, you notice he declares this day, that day, and God said it was good. It was really good. You hit chapter 3, our first parents fall. They drag the whole creation down a slippery slope. Romans states that our fall from God, or, you know, Adam and Eve fall from God, corrupted the entire universe. It didn't just corrupt them. It did corrupt them. We think that the laws of physics were changed. We think that that introduced entropy. You know what entropy is? Everything wears down. Everything gets old. It goes from an ordered state to a disordered state. The laws of thermodynamics. Some good science brainies that are Christians think that it actually changed the physical universe. Some people think it changed the speed of light. All these different things that would bring about this incredible change. Worst of all, it brought about pain, suffering, death, and that's the physical side. Separation from God on the spiritual side. They were no longer, Adam walked with God in the garden. He no longer walked with God in the garden. It became the first, you might say, watershed event of the original creation. It's just like everything changed, right? Well, now the flood and our post-flood story accelerates the downward spiral, because literally everything in the world is going to get reshaped now. You got new mountains, new mountain ranges. You got new coastlines. Rivers disappear and reappear in different routes. Fossils of life are deposited all over the world, sometimes on mountaintops. With the collapse of the firmament that was around the world that we see in Genesis, is we are now exposed to deadly cosmic rays. Where, you know, we know skin cancer. I've had skin cancer, you know, in my head. I had a little, nothing real major, but everything's changed. You no longer have that greenhouse effect around the earth that kept it very temperate all around the world. It was a garden. Now you have ice caps on the North and South Pole, the original Garden of Eden and the Tree of Life. They're gone. They're gone. They're wiped out. When Noah stepped out of the ark, it was not recognizable to where he went in. It was different. You know, in the post-flood, everything has changed, and God has a lot more to add to this in our story today. We're covering 9 and 10, probably a summary of 10 with the genealogies of Noah's son. But our world, our title today is the post-flood world, and we just got two things we're going to talk about in an outline. A changed world, that's chapter 9, and then the sons of Noah and their descendants, that would be the three sons of Noah. So let's look at this changed world. So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So the initial command when they get out of the ark is to replenish the earth. We know that Noah has no more kids, but the three sons and their wives are going to repopulate the whole earth. And it's up to them. All of them, all of us here today are descendants of Shem, Japheth, and Ham. We'll talk a little bit about that in chapter 10. Or a combination of them, a combination of them. They have traced through genetic testing. I found this really interesting. I found this on Answers in Genesis, that the Y chromosome, they've traced it down to, it was a real long number on each one of them. I didn't bring it with me, but they trace it down to three genetic chromosomes, the Y chromosomes, that all of the family of the earth has one or the other, or the mixture. They might have, well, the Y chromosome, it's not a mixture, but the lineage would be a mixture. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, every bird of the air, on all that moves on the earth and all the fish of the sea, they are given into your hands. So, you know, man retains the dominion over the animals, but now the animal kingdom has the fear of man built into them. You guys have, I remember when we were kids, we were trying to catch birds. You know, you put the box up with the stick, right? You guys know what I'm talking about? They won't go in there. They kind of know. They have that fear of man. But and you try and go up to a wild animal, and they have that fear built into them. It's not like the creation of the pre-flood. It seemed like Noah, God brought the animals to him. So our diet also changed with an exception. It says, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. So we went from a vegetarian to an omnivore. We eat vegetables. Meat is okay at this point. I would not suggest eating a possum on the road, though. You know, I don't like the looks of possums anyway. They're kind of mousy or something. I don't know what it is, you know. But you shall not eat, so you can eat everything. Now, God's going to narrow it down for Israel, clean animals only. He's going to narrow it down to that. So that diet was not for the Gentiles. It was for Israel. It's for a specific purpose if you ever get into it. Some people retain being a vegetarian. That's cool. That's cool. I'm an omnivore. I am. I like both, you know. But you shall not eat flesh with his life, that is the blood. You're not supposed to eat the blood. Now, there's a lot of different reasons for that. Raw blood was not to be consumed as food. This is not just a Mosaic law prohibition. This comes before. This comes before the Mosaic law is going to be probably about 1,000 years after the flood. So raw blood is not to be consumed as food. The Mosaic law has a prohibition, but it's banned from the very beginning. It's banned from the very beginning. It's kind of interesting because we see a lot of different cultures that maybe practice demonic things that for some reason it's the very thing that they're drawn to. They drink blood and different things like that. They drink blood, and they're generally associated with demonic worship or something like that. Now, this kind of makes sense in the New Testament, Acts. They had the Jerusalem Council, where Paul was bringing before the Jerusalem Council, should the Gentiles obey the Mosaic law? And they said, no, they shouldn't. That's for Israel. But here's a couple things. Stay away from meat offered to idols, and don't eat something that's strangled. In other words, if you're going to eat meat, you got to drain the carcass or whatever. So consuming meat would require a draining of the blood, and that's how when any of the slaughtering houses in the process, then one of the very first things they do is they drain the blood. So, and blood is also going to signify Jesus is going to drain his blood for us. It's going to have a parallel spiritual identity. So surely for you, now here's another thing. Surely for your blood I will demand a reckoning. For the hand of every beast I will require, from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother I will require. But whoever sheds man's blood by man, blood shall be shed. For the image of God he was made. So capital punishment from the very beginning of time, you know, or after the flood at least, capital punishment is established by God. Now this is not, people say, well, you can't go to war, different things. This is murder. This is about murder. And if you go into the Mosaic law, there's a difference between if you accidentally kill somebody, there's a difference of war, going to war, that's different, than a premeditated type of murder, or what we call first and second degree murder, where you kill somebody out of rage or whatever. That is what capital punishment is for, something like that. And, you know, they've cut that off pretty much without the, about the land now. There's only a few states that keep that up. But it's about murder, not war, not accidental killings. But God gives man the responsibility to lay out that punishment. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth, and I will multiply it. Then God spoke to Noah and to his son, saying, and as for me, behold, I will establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth, us, I will establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Now, it's kind of interesting. This covenant that God establishes for all mankind, at this point, the three sons of Noah and himself, you would consider them Gentiles. The Hebrew race has not been established yet. It has not been separated. The Jews will eventually be established through Shem. Okay, so that covenant is not just for Israel. Israel has its own covenants. You know, we have many covenants when you think about it. You have the covenant of Noah. You have the covenant of Abraham. You have the Mosaic covenant. You have the new covenant. All these different things that God has established covenants with. But this particular covenant, I'm never going to destroy the earth again. So help me, right? I'm never going to destroy the earth again by a flood. Now, we have local floods. People are killed. But he's talking about worldwide. People die in fires and floods and everything else. The covenant God establishes with all mankind will be that God will never destroy all living things through a worldwide flood. Now, we know in the future, judgment is coming on the land. You guys know judgment is coming on America. I don't know when. I pray that God has mercy on us. I pray that God has mercy on my children. I pray that God has mercy on my grandchildren. But there is judgment coming on America. It's going to come in the whole world. And that judgment to come will not wipe out all humanity. You look in the book of Revelation, you see a quarter of the people die. Then you see a third of the people die. That equals about half of the world. But never the whole world, you know, in his judgment. And God establishes a sign of the covenant for us to remember the promise. You guys know what it is. It's a rainbow. It's a rainbow. And unfortunate that the New Age groups and other groups have stolen the meaning of the rainbow. They've stolen the meaning. When you see a rainbow in the sky, you rejoice. He says this: this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you, for perpetual generations, that means for forever. I will set a rainbow in the cloud. It shall be for a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature and of all flesh. The water shall never again become a flood to destroy the flesh, or destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature for all flesh that is on the earth. So when you are looking up at the rainbow, God is looking at that rainbow too. Know that. He is looking at that to remind us that he will not do that again. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and you and all flesh that is in the earth. So this covenant, he's never going to destroy it again. It's kind of interesting. Whenever you see a rainbow, you got to tell somebody. Look at the rainbow, right? You look at the rainbow. Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting to watch. Or you see the double rainbow. Did you ever see a double rainbow? That's God is thinking on both of those, by the way, you know. And we can think on both those things too, that he is faithful. Last summer, we were walking out of the prayer meeting. It was probably in the summertime because it was still kind of light out. And there was a real light rain. I don't even know if it rained around here. And we just, three or four of us came out of the prayer meeting. Man, this rainbow was just across, all the way across the sky. All the way across the sky. And it just always draws you. And all of us stopped and looked. And then we began to speak about this covenant that God established with Noah and with all of us. I will never destroy the whole world with a flood again. So the true meaning of the rainbow is what that song that Dave played this morning, it's God's faithfulness. It's God's faithfulness. He's never going to do that. You know, God never makes a promise he doesn't keep. Never makes a promise he doesn't keep. He always keeps his promises. He does not lie. Now, next, we have this odd story of Noah and his three sons. Now, the sons of Noah, who went out of the ark, were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. Now, if you look at this, and we'll go through a little bit in chapter 10, we're going to summarize some of those the people that came out of these guys. But Shem is the line eventually to be the line of the Hebrews, the line of Jesus. Shem is that. Japheth, if you're of European, all the way from Russia to all Western European, that was Japheth. That was Japheth. Ham happens to be like, well, we'll find out the Canaanites were of Ham. Africa was of Ham. Different things like that. Now, the sons of Noah who went out, all of us here are one of those or a mixture of those things, of Japheth, Shem, and Ham. These three were the sons of Noah, and from those the whole earth was populated, and Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. So we're talking 20, 30 years after this. We know that he lived 300 and something years after the flood. So this is many years down the road. These three guys, Noah's sons, have already had children and more children. We know that Canaan is born at that time. These three sons of Noah, from these three, the whole earth was populated. And Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. That takes a while. Then he drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. Noah drinking, became drunk, and then is naked. He's naked in the tent. Now, this is the first mention of wine in the Bible and the first mention of drunkenness. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Now, verse 22 has the implications of telling his brothers almost in a delight, in a mocking way, disrespecting his father, disrespecting his father. So when he goes out to tell, hey, look at the old man, you know, or something like that, disrespecting his dad. The other two sons, better sense, more loyal, more respectable. And Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and they went backwards and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away. They did not see their father's nakedness. So Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him. Now, it could have been, we know that Noah is going to curse Canaan, Ham's son, and it's interesting because it's more prophetic than anything else. He's going to prophesy about Canaan. But it could have been as simple as Ham disrespecting his dad. It could have been that simple. Some commentators think it's possibly something more. Maybe sexual, anything like that. We don't know that. It never says exactly what it is. But when you see that term uncovered, a lot of times that has a sexual meaning in the Bible, but we don't know that. I like to keep it just as simple. It's probably a great disrespect of Noah. So, but there is this strong reaction of Noah to his grandson, actually. Then he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brethren. And he said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth. Actually, Japheth covered the most territory of the world, by the way. And may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. Now, there are so many things about this. You know, slavery was based on this with people. They said, well, you know, Africa is basically Ham's territory. They based that, but here it is. He's not cursing those in Africa. He's cursing Canaan, which was still in the land of Palestine, or back then, the land of Israel. So, to me, that it's just a justification for an evil practice. What I see here, and it's pretty simple to me, is that Canaan was, that Noah is actually prophesying about the future of Canaan. We know that they became a horrible nation. I mean, horrible idolatry, sexual practices, murdering their babies, sacrificing their babies to Molech and all the different gods back then. So that whole thing about slavery, I mean, I just, you know, it's just people want to think that way. They justified it by that, but there was no justification. But this could be as simple as Noah prophesying. He's predicting that then Canaan, he doesn't go to any of the other sons of Ham. He just goes to Canaan, is going to receive a curse. And he was cursed. You know, when Abraham was in the land, God predicted, he says, you know, in 400 years, you're going to come out of the land of Egypt, and you're going to come back into the land, and you're going to wipe out these people. A lot of people have weird problems with that, you know, wiping out a race. But if you study any archaeology and look at it, it was a very evil, evil practice, man. They would heat up a bronze statue of Molech and lay their children on this, you know. I mean, it's pretty wicked. They would sacrifice and they would have sex in the temples and all that stuff. They would kill, they would murder. It was a very evil race. And God has the right to judge a race. He judged Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around the plain of the Jordan. It's just, you know, when you think about it, it's like, it's up to here and God doesn't judge. It's up to here, God doesn't judge. There's a point where God judges. There's a point where God judges. We talked about that in the flood, that the times of Noah were no more evil than our times, that what we can see. There had to be more going on during that time. So this could be as simple as Noah predicting the destiny of Canaan. We know that the culture of the evil Canaanites, years down the road, Israel was commanded to take the land and destroy the people. So it could be that simple. And Noah lived after the flood 350 years. So all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. So that's the changed world. We see there's a big change. There's this, we had the change when they sinned, and now we had the change when the flood happened. We're going to talk about another couple changes toward the end of this sermon. So now when you look at the genealogy, we're going to look at the sons of Noah. This is chapter 10. When we look at the genealogy of Noah, many of these names will come up in historical narratives in the Bible. They'll come up, all of a sudden you'll see Ashur, or you'll see Shem even in there, or you see different things. But here's what happens, is that they do come up in the narratives, and they come up in prophecies in the Bible. It helps, this really helps, it you know, if you can read half those names in there. I'm not going to read all of them, because I can't pronounce half of them. So we're going to summarize the ones that are important, that are in the Bible, okay? It's interesting that God addresses, when he addresses a nation in the Old Testament, you know, he addresses, I'm going to judge this nation. I'm going to, Magog, he's in here. He's one of the sons of Japheth. All right? When he addresses other nations, he'll use the very beginning names that we see in chapter 10 to address that nation, which is good because we know that different nations change their names. Iran, Persia, Madai. So you know, we can go back and say, oh, chapter 10, oh, that is Persia. That's Iran today. That's Iran. So it's good for us to be able to do that. So when God does that, he addresses in the Old Testament. So it's good to know where some of this stuff is. And I'm only going to address the things that are that I know that are later on addressed in the Bible. Now, this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The sons were born to them, and the sons that were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, that's right there, that's Persia, Javan, Tubal, Meshach, and Tiras. Now, Japheth was the father of the Indo-European nations. That's like from, you talk about the west coast of Europe all the way into India. And not going south, but may stand more of that whole latitude. So there, if you have ancestry in that, I did my DNA and most of my ancestry is from Ireland. I don't look too Irish, do I, you guys? I had one guy look at me and he says, man, you look like, he says, you're really Irish looking, aren't you? You know? So I was disappointed in that. I'm only a little bit of English, you know, so. Japheth was the father of the Indo-European people. Then now you have Gomer. That's German. The German, Austria, you know, Prussia, all in that area. But you have the Western Europeans, French, okay, Spanish. You have the Celtic settlers. That would be Ireland. That would be my ancestry. So, and then you have Magog, Tubal, and Meshach mentioned in prophecies throughout the Bible. They're mentioned both in Ezekiel and mentioned in the book of Revelation. Magog is mentioned there. Magog, that's all Russia. That's the Scythians. They moved from the Scythians, they moved north and they settled into Russia. And then Madai is Persia or Iran. That Javan, that's the Greeks. So you have all these different nations. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz. Well, let me read down to from these. All right, from the sons of and we're talking about the sons of Gomer, and we're talking about the sons of Javan. From these, the coastline people of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language. You'll see that the Tower of Babel in a little bit. According to their families, into their nations. Now, it's very interesting. People study languages, how they connect to each other. These nations are linked by languages similar to each other. English is very related to German and French, and you got all that in there. So the similarities, they seem kind of invisible on the surface, but when you get down to studying them, and they have done the studies, they're connected. They're connected together. And so the Bible states in verse 5 that their families are all connected together. Then you get into the sons of Ham in verse 6. It says the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. Canaan is going to be very much highlighted when you get into the historical books of the Bible. So you have that. Notice in verse 10, they mention Sheba and Dedan. That's also mentioned in the prophecies of Ezekiel 38 and 39. And other parts of the Bible, that's Saudi Arabia. That could be Yemen down in that area. That's in the news lately. Cush, verse 8, begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. So This is not a compliment, by the way. This is not a compliment. This is a derogatory statement that he's offensive to the Lord. He's offensive to the Lord. And it's not a compliment. So, and the beginning of his kingdom, we're talking about Nimrod, was Babel, which is the Tower of Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calna, in the land of Shinar. The land of Shinar is where the Babylonian Empire eventually grows up. So Assyria and Nineveh are mentioned, if you look at verse 11, Assyria and Nineveh, that's Jonah's turf when he got spit out of the whale and went up there and he preached to the Ninevites and they repented. So you see Nineveh, a principal city in verse 12. Verse 14 mentions, if you look at it, the Philistines. That's going to be prolific in the historical. I mean, Israel's enemy was the Philistines. David's enemy was the Philistines. So you see that. That's all from Ham. You also mentioned the verse 15, the Canaanites. The Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jezebite, the Amorite, and the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, the Termite, you guys are paying attention, right? All right, I'm just making sure. Whoever laughed first was really zoning in. He probably heard that joke before. And Sinite. Interesting. The Sinite would be the Orientals, or the Far East. You talk about China, Thailand, Japan, all out that way. And eventually, we know that the original American Indians, or some of the South American, were from all of this too. They would have that mixture. Now, South America, you have a lot of Spanish coming in there, so it's kind of all mixed together. You got Japheth mixing with Ham in South America, and all these different things. But the Orientals were genetically traced, or the Indians were traced to the Orientals. And we know that they came over on the bridge. Down to verse 19, and the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon toward Gera, as far as Gaza. Gaza's in the news. Gaza pretty much stayed that little area there for a long time, and it's even to this day. Then you go toward Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zebulun, and Lasha. That's those towns around the base of the end of the Jordan River before it dumps into the Dead Sea. These were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, in the lands and in their nations. Last but not least, you got Shem. And children were born also to Shem, the father of the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth and the elder. Now, that's not the same. Japheth is the same. He's the brother of. That's kind of interesting because Shem is not the firstborn. Japheth is. So you jump down to verse 25. If you look at that, then Eber was born two sons. The name of one is Peleg, and for the earth in his days were divided, and the brother's name was Joktan. Now, Eber is the lineage of the Hebrews. So one of the reasons I pointed out him is because the Bible is going to follow that lineage all the way down. You're going to see it in Matthew. You're going to see it in Luke. You're going to see that lineage. You'll see Peleg in there. You'll see Joktan, or you'll see Peleg because he's firstborn. But you'll see that the Bible's going to follow that because it eventually, where does it go? Jesus, right? It goes to Jesus. That's the lineage. So great, 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 great grandfather is, this Eber, and then his son Peleg, the one less great, I guess. So you're gonna see that lineage follow all the way down to Jesus. Verse 30, and their dwelling place was from Mesha toward Sepher, the mountains of the east. These are the sons of Shem according to their families, according to their language, and their lands according to their nations. These were the families of the son of Noah according to their generations in their nation. And from these, the nations were divided on the earth after the flood. Now, skipping back, remember it said that there was a division of the earth back then? That was probably talking about some kind of earthquake that they had during the time of that Peleg. So we've been talking about the flood. You know, we looked at this changed world, how the flood changed everything. We know that creation got changed when they sinned. Then this change happened. The Grand Canyon was formed. All these different things were formed. How the flood changed everything. And then you see the genealogies. Everything's in the Bible. It's really important to be able to, you know, it's hard to read those names. It's hard to pronounce. But, and what I wanted to do is highlight the ones that we will see in the Bible later on. And you can learn a lot from Genesis, especially with the foundation for studying the Bible. So if you guys get a chance, don't stop reading Genesis. Keep going. You're going to come into Abraham pretty soon. Very interesting stories. You're going to come into Ishmael. You're going to come in, you know, the Arabs, how they, today, the Arabs, they fought back then and they're still fighting today, Israel and the Arabs. But you can learn a lot. So it's really important. And one of the reasons we got into the book of Genesis was to get a foundation. Good foundation in the book. If you guys haven't listened to all of Genesis, I think there's 13 studies in there. You can go on our website and grab that. So next week, we're going to have this detailed study of the epistle to the Philippians. I just want to talk about two more changes that are going to happen, these watershed changes. When Jesus Christ comes back, go toward the end of Revelation, you know, chapter 19, 20, 21, and 22. When he comes back, he's going to reign on earth. And some of you guys maybe were raised where you don't necessarily believe in the millennium, that thousand-year reign of Christ. I believe it. It's pretty plain in the Bible that it's there in the book of Revelation. He's going to come back to earth, and he's going to reign for 1,000 years on earth. Things are going to change again. It says the wolf will lie down with the lamb, right? It says that he's going to beat the war implements into farming implements. And there's not going to be war anymore. So that's another big change. That's another big change. Then you have the final change where the earth and the heavens, heaven and earth flees away from the Father's face, and he creates a brand new heaven and earth with the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven for those that are faithful to him, for those that are his. So these fundamental changes we see in the Bible, the flood, creation, the millennium, the end of days are all there before us. And just encourage you guys to rejoice that if you know the Lord, rejoice that you're part of that. You're part of that. You're safe and sound. He promised that. He promised that he would come back and get us and take us to heaven.